When people speak of the possibility of accomplishing great things, other people just shrug their shoulders and say, it's impossible. Why bother trying? Here's what O'Neill said of Carter. He said, most of the time, a president meets with members of Congress at the beginning of their presidency, and the president outlines three or four items or issues he'd like to accomplish while in office. And then there's sort of an agreement that he'll get certain things in regard to those issues in return for consideration of other issues. But in Carter's case, we asked him what he wanted to accomplish, and he gave us a list. It was pages and pages and pages long. And we just looked at him and looked at the list and decided there wasn't any way to take him seriously. That's what O'Neill said. The problem, I think, though, with incremental change is that it never actually solves problems. It actually prolongs them. Incremental change merely makes it seem like problems are being addressed. Well, I participated in a test once. It actually relates to this. The test was an inquiry into whether people accomplished more by setting a pace and slowly, methodically working towards something, or whether people actually accomplish more by throwing themselves into something, doing everything they possibly can, and when they get tired, resting, and then getting up and doing it all over again. The experiential side of that test was that on the first day, you had to run a mile the way you always would approach running a mile when you're out of shape. And by the way, 60% of the mile was uphill. People closed their eyes, went slow, paced themselves. Prior to doing this, I'd been in a motorcycle accident, and for the previous 6 weeks, I'd been flat on my back recovering. My right arm was even in a sling, so I was in particularly bad shape. First day, I ran that mile in 26 minutes. The next day, they told us instead to run as hard as we could, rest when we got tired, then run as hard as we possibly could again. The second day, I ran that mile in less than 12 minutes. And it wasn't because I was in better physical condition. It had everything to do with being willing to try something new and then embracing the results. The results of that little test changed the way I work, and I get a lot done. In addition, instead of closing my eyes and managing the pain that came with the work, we were instructed to maintain focus on what was ahead of us, the goal, the task at hand. It just flat out worked. But somehow I think Jimmy Carter understands this principle too. It's the same thing John and Robert Kennedy knew too. It's that the commitment to an outcome, it makes the biggest difference. Having the answers is least important. Answering the question before proposing the challenge simply destroys possibility. It's the commitment and holding true to the vision that motivates us to get things done. The answers to the problems of the world are available if we're willing to hear them. This is the text of the Jimmy Carter Nobel citation. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2002 to Jimmy Carter for his decades of untiring effort to find peaceful solutions to international conflicts, to advance democracy and human rights, and to promote economic and social development. During his presidency, Carter's mediation was a vital contribution to the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt, in itself a great enough achievement to qualify for the Nobel Peace Prize. At a time when the Cold War between East and West was still predominant, he played renewed emphasis on the place of human rights in international politics. Through his Carter Center, which celebrates its 20th anniversary in 2002, Carter has since his presidency undertaken very extensive and persevering conflict resolution on several continents. He has shown outstanding commitment to human rights and has served as an observer at countless elections all over the world. He has worked hard on many fronts to fight tropical diseases and to bring about growth and progress in developing countries. Carter has thus been active in several of the problem areas that have figured prominently in the over 100 years of Peace Prize history. In a situation currently marked by threats of the use of power, Carter has stood by the principles that conflicts must, as far as possible, be resolved through mediation and international cooperation based on international law, respect for human rights, and economic development. If you'd like to read more about Jimmy Carter, there's plenty more to see on the link to the CNN website. In entertainment, not going to do the usual thing tonight. I just actually have a story I want to read to you about Bruce Springsteen and The Rising. This comes off of MSNBC. The title of the story, Tramps Like Us in Paris. Excluding terrorist attacks on my hometown, I never feel so patriotic as when seeing Bruce Springsteen play Bride. Monday night's show in Paris was not a spectacular Springsteen show. He did not do any of those special gift songs like A Solo Piano Incident or Kitty's Back After Land of Hopes and Dreams. But he did perform with a spirit and a power that's not always present at home. Per usual, the show was built around The Rising, the title song, already a warhorse, but one doing double duty in the categories of both defiance and redemption, opened the show and suffered from muddy sound, but was redeemed by energetic performance. The crowd looked like any other Springsteen crowd, which is to uplift it and transport it. This was particularly evident during the late show. Kick Out the Jam's Dance Numbers, the funky new version of Dancing in the Dark, and a 20-megaton version of Ramrod. The highlight for me, however, was the searing Born in the USA, restored to its rock and roll roots and placed, as far as one could tell, as a warning against war in Iraq. But it also seemed to be a cry of patriotic solidarity with the men and women about to have their lives ended, or at least badly messed up there. Perhaps this is conjecture on my part. Springsteen's comments have been limited to decrying the loss of civil liberties attendant with Attorney General John Ashcroft's exploitation of the war on terrorism. But nobody in Paris seems to be supporting going to war, and America is not terribly popular here now for a whole set of reasonable and a few unreasonable reasons. Yet, I don't know, 18,000 or so French people were thrusting their fists in the air, singing Born in the USA and appearing in some inexplicable fashion to mean it with all their hearts. There are two ways to look at America from abroad right now. The easy one is the simplistic caricature, to which unfortunately George Bush and his neoconservative advisors play as if cast from birth for the role. The arrogant, ignorant cowboy who comes to shoot up the place, Bible in one hand, six gun in the other, all the while telling the natives what's good for them. Then there's the real America. The more complex reality that contains this man and the culture that produced him, but also so much more, the immigrant struggles, the racial improvements, the everyday heroism of the working poor. The innovative spirit of Louis Armstrong and the rebellious ethos of young Bob Dylan and Elvis, the sex appeal of the Supremes. That's Bruce Springsteen's America, and if the nations have ever had a more effective ambassador abroad, well, maybe Ben Franklin, maybe Thomas Jefferson, and maybe John Adams, but that's it. And anyway, those people at Bercy had a much better time than they would have had reciting the Declaration of Independence. Tramps like us, indeed. Way to go to Bruce. With that, I consider you a little more informed. And that's a wrap. This is Charles at DemocraticFundamentalism.org. You have a great night.